what's the time?
It's time to get ill.
And what's the time?
It's time to get ill.
So what's the time?
It's time to get ill.
Now what's the time?
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Illiteracy Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Benson, a senior policy analyst at the Heartland Institute, a national free market think tank. Thanks for tuning in again. This is episode 130-something. Bad habit of mine, I never remember the episode numbers, so sorry about that, but it's somewhere in the 130s. But for those of you just tuning in for the first time, if you haven't listened to the podcast before, basically what we do here on the podcast is I invite an author on to discuss a book of theirs that's been newly published or recently published and on a topic or thing or idea or person, et cetera, that we think you guys would like to hear a conversation about. And then hopefully at the end of the podcast or, you know, even in the middle of the podcast, if you get your druthers about you, you go ahead and purchase the book itself and then give it a read. So if you like this podcast, please consider giving Illiteracy a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show, and also by sharing with your friends, as that's the best way to support programming like this. And my guest today is Dr. Joanne Paul, and Dr. Paul is an honorary senior lecturer in intellectual history at the University of Sussex, as well as a fellow of the Royal Historical Society, an associate fellow of the Higher Education Academy, and a BBC AHRC New Generation Thinker. Her research focuses on the history of the Renaissance and early modern periods, and her books include Counsel and Command in Early Modern English Thought and an entry in the Classical Thinker series on Thomas More's thoughts and writings. And her latest book is The House of Dudley, A New History of Tudor England, which was published last March by Pegasus Books and I believe is newly available in paperback. I'm pretty sure I saw that on Amazon. But anyway, it is the, So there you go. Newly available in paperback. And it is the book we will be discussing today. So Dr. Paul, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's always nice to get an invitation from that side of the pond. I'm in the UK now, and but I am North American. I'm Canadian. So it's nice to talk to you.
No, thank you very much. So speaking of Canada, I think it said in the flap, you're from Toronto, right?
I was born in Toronto, yeah.
Born in Toronto. So did you grow up in Canada and then head over, or was it,
Yeah. I grew up in a little city called Brockville, which if anyone has traveled around Ontario, you might have passed through. not many people stop there. Sort of near Kingston. And then I did my undergraduate and my master's in Canada before doing my PhD in the UK.
Gotcha. So got to ask you, are you a hockey fan, Maple Leafs fan?
I mean, I have to, I think, or they take away the passport. I mean, in terms of teams, I have various loyalties.
Do you, I guess, just have you watched Letterkenny at all? Or shows, have you heard of Letterkenny? You haven't heard of Letterkenny?
No.
Oh, my God. Okay.
No idea what you're talking about.
It's a Canadian comedy series, and it's set in, I guess it's supposed to be like a little like town sort of by Sudbury up way up.
Yeah.
And so it follows like there's three groups, like the Hicks, the hockey players, and the Skids. And
it's all very familiar to me.
I have a feeling you would love it. It's been on for like 12 seasons or something like that, and we get it here. Well, they just wrapped up the show, and we get it here on Hulu, but it's on like Crave or something like that. Anyway, if you get a chance, you should.
It's so hard sometimes to get programming, especially Canadian programming, over here, but even some American stuff, it's really hard to get. Like, it took forever till I could see Schitt's Creek, for instance. You know, like that sort of, like, it just takes a while. But I will look out for it. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a little bit more lowbrow than Schitt's Creek. But it's funny because like I know I've talked to a lot of people, a lot of Americans who have had like, because it's so Canadian, that they've had like a hard time with like the dialogue and the accents. And but like what? But I you know I'm I I'm from Jersey. I grew up playing hockey and, you know, been a huge hockey fan my whole life. So like, I'm sort of used to it. Like, so, but like, once you get in that, like you get in the rhythm of it, it's like very easy to, but I'm telling you, you would absolutely love Letterkenny. So yeah, if you get a chance, check it out.
Feel like visiting home.
Yeah. Right. All right. Well, congratulations on the success of the book. It was Times of London named it a book of the year, I think.
Yeah. So yeah, a few others named it book of the year when it came out.
Yeah, there you go. So that's awesome. But yeah. Okay. So it's been it's a well thought of book. Obviously, it's very great. I really, really enjoyed it. But what was the genesis of this book for you? Like, what made you how did you have the idea for the book? What made you want to write it?
Yeah, it was years ago, actually, when I was doing my PhD in London, and I was looking through various 16th century Tudor texts, and I came across this pamphlet called Leicester's Commonwealth, which is actually where the book itself begins. This pamphlet talking about the various crimes of the Dudley family.
And yeah, it's not a very nice pamphlet.
No, it's a bit mean. It's also hilarious, though, because it's particularly talking about Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester. And at one point, it talks about an Italian ointment that he needs in order to have his member perform in the bedroom. And at one point, it accuses him of killing someone with a salad, which I think is unique in English history, as far as I'm aware. So it has fun moments. But yeah, it's very mean about the Dudley family, calls them a tribe of traitors.
They pulled no punches back then.
Exactly. No, none. And accuses them of raising their children, essentially, to be traitors. And I read it, and I thought, well, you know, obviously this can't all be true. But of course, in all three of the generations, Robert's included, someone ends up executed for treason. So there's something going on with this family. And it just made me curious about the culture of that family. Every family has its own culture. What was the culture of this family that produces this constant sort of rise and very dramatic fall? I thought, wouldn't this be a great topic for a book? And I just sort of put it away in the back of my mind for a few years. And then on the back of the book you mentioned about Thomas More, I'd published some articles in various history magazines. And a literary agent contacted me and he said, I think you can write. Have you ever thought about writing a trade book? And I said, well, actually, I have this idea. And I sort of pulled it out and he went, yeah, that one. And we ran with it from there because it's just such a compelling story. I sort of just had to get out of its way while I was writing because there's just so much there.
Yeah. So whenever it seems like every time I read a book on the medieval, the Renaissance periods, I'm always like, why did these people go through with all of this? I mean, the nobility, I mean, you know, there just seems to me very little upside to being a member of a court and, or of sticking your neck out in any way, shape or form. It just sort of seems like very high risk, high reward. And I feel like if I were in the nobility back then, I just been like, I don't want any part of this. I'm just gonna sit here in my ancestral home and, you know, go sit on the porch and kick back and whittle, or, you know, do something where it's just something where the events just literally just everything can just pass me by, and I don't have to worry about, you know, being drawn and quartered or beheaded and, you know, or dying you know, of dysentery in the tower or something like that. You know what I mean? So why did so many families, noble families, feel like they had to participate in this, this, you know, quote unquote Game of Thrones, you know, type stuff?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. And as I spent time with the Dudley family, it was one I kept coming back to. You know, as you say, just on a general scale, why does anyone, but also why did these specific people? And I think the Dudleys are an interesting example because they don't start as nobles. Mm-hmm. The first Dudley that we encounter in the book is Edmund Dudley. He's a lawyer. He's the eldest son of a younger son of a baron. So there's nobility back there, but he's the younger line. So he's just a gentleman. He has some holdings in Sussex, but he's very much no big deal. And he shouldn't have mattered to history. We shouldn't really be talking about him. But he did want to make his mark. And I think with Edmund, it is the case of trying to prove that he is important, to prove that he is someone. We get these wonderful, really telling encounters with him where people are putting him down, sort of trying to put him back in his place. And the passion with which he responds to this sort of defensiveness that then becomes aggression, I think really tells us a lot about how he thought of himself and this sort of almost self-consciousness that he had about his position. So I think for him, it was very much trying to show that he was worth something. And as it continues, you know, once you sort of enter that game, if we want to think about it that way, it's all about maintaining that position, because any fall it becomes dramatic once you're up there. And it's very interesting. By the time we get to his son, John, we've got these amazing letters where he's really reflecting on the cost of the sort of continuing to participate. And we see that almost sort of counterintuitively, it's about security, that he's trying to create security for his family by accruing power and by rising up the ladder. But of course, counter to that, the higher the rise, the bigger the fall. So that they're stuck in this almost sort of paradox where they have to keep climbing in order to maintain everything. It's like capitalism. They have to keep growing.
It's like being like a hamster in a wheel or something like that.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. But the higher they go, the higher the risk. Mm-hmm. I think at the end of the day, and this is a sort of what I chose as a theme running through it, is it's about sort of making a mark, about lasting longer than one's own death, because it is the 16th century. People die for all sorts of reasons, both dramatic and mundane. Mm-hmm. And I think that they wanted to have this sense of sort of legacy in the same way that people today do, you know? I mean, you think, you know, the sort of high risk, high reward isn't exactly the same, dysentery in the tower or beheading, but there's a lot of, you know, public falls are still pretty dire, and people still keep climbing, keep trying. And so I think the motivations are probably very similar.
Well, I'm sure. But it seems like everybody's got an enemy, you know. I mean, was there like anybody back then who was just sort of like universally beloved, like sort of like everyone's like, hey, I really like that guy, you know? Or was there like a Paul Rudd of like medieval, you know, like medieval England or Renaissance England, where everyone's like, hey, you know, he's showing up. I like that guy.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is something that I'm actually very, very interested in, is finding these people who sort of just get on, you mm-hmm. know, and we were less likely to hear of them, which makes sense. But for example, someone who appears in the book, who becomes, when Edmund Dudley, and I'm spoiling everything, is executed for treason, his son is six at the time. He then goes on to live with a guardian named Edward Guildford. And he's, I think, just someone who, gets on with everybody, doesn't really become very controversial. He's master of the king's armory, so he's still up there. He's knighted. Mm-hmm. He's got a nice little country manor in Kent. And there are those figures. It does happen. I'm always fascinated too by William Kingston, who's the constable of the Tower, and he's the one who, you know, takes these last interviews and is there in the last days of people like Anne Boleyn and Thomas mm-hmm. More, and you know, all of these figures, and they all talk to him and they all open up to him and, you know, share their last moments with him, and yeah, he sort of just gets on. So yeah, I'm very fascinated by those figures. They do exist. So if you find yourself in the 16th century, you could do it.
Yeah. Now, the fates of the Dudleys and of the Tudors, are sort of intertwined. Both houses basically expire without an heir, you know, in the not too far apart from each other. And it seems like it's a relationship that is sort of mutually symbiotic and also parasitic at the same time. Does that make sense?
I love that. Yeah, I think that's spot on, and I may borrow it.
Okay. as a
script there. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. The Tudors as a dynasty, as a ruling dynasty, really depend on the Dudleys. Henry VII could not have handed the throne to his son, Henry VIII, with such security had not Edmund Dudley accrued all this money for him. And John Dudley ends up really revitalizing the Tudor Navy and leading Henry VIII's armies in various conflicts, and very much supporting Edward VI. But Mary I really couldn't do that well without executing him. And same with Henry VIII and Edmund Dudley. So there's this sense in which I always say that every Tudor monarch, and it's very much the case, either depended on a Dudley at their side or crushed one beneath their feet in order to sort of gain the popularity that came from destroying someone very unpopular. So it is, as you say, both sort of symbiotic and parasitic. I mean, I think the Dudleys, they certainly had ambition, and they do end up on the throne for about a week and a half, literally. But I think that they took service very seriously. And there's this sort of black legend that surrounds them that they are treacherous, you know, back to Leicester's Commonwealth, that they are always out to get power from themselves and to steal the throne. But I think they were really interested in serving the Tudors. And I think that they did so in all sorts of really important, significant ways.
Mm-hmm. All right. So maybe we should back up, because I'm not sure how many listeners are, you know, how much they're really familiar with this period. But so a little background on the Tudors first. They're... they're a new dynasty. You know, Henry VII managed to takes the throne from the Plantagenets, who had ruled England for over 300 years, 330 years, something.
Oh,
like
very,
that.
Very, very long time. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so the Tudor situation at the start, well, it really throughout the entire Tudor dynasty, it always seems very, very precarious, the whole dynasty. And so how does Edmund, as you mentioned, who's just a commoner, or, you know, he's a lawyer, how does Edmund become so indispensable to Henry VII, who is the man who starts the Tudor dynasty?
It comes back to, as you say, this precarity. I think we have a tendency to view the Tudors as this sort of monolithic, inevitable dynasty, but they weren't. And you're right to point out that's through the century and a bit that they ruled. They were constantly teetering on the edge of disappearing entirely. And that's very, very true for Henry VII, and especially true for the last sort of decade or so of his reign, because he had up to that point, for about 15 years, managed to fend off every rebellion and pretender to the throne and threat and everything else, and had managed to produce two heirs, or an heir and a spare, as they say, right? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, at the beginning of the 16th century, the heir dies, leaving only the spare, which is not a position that Henry VII wanted to be in. His queen also dies, so there's no hope of more. And that spare, who's now the heir, is Prince Henry, who does become Henry VIII, but there's they don't know that at that point, that it could go any way. And in his grief and in this difficult position, Henry VII sort of becomes a bit paranoid. And in particular, he becomes obsessed with accruing coin, essentially trying to ensure that this transition of power from himself to his son will take place by sort of filling up the coffers, but also making everyone owe him money so that they won't rebel against him, and sort of having everyone by the purse strings. And there is one person in the realm who really, really knows these archaic, moth-eaten, ignored laws about the king's prerogative that he could use to have everyone in these strings of financial obligation. And that's Edmund Dudley. So he just sort of has the right expertise at the right time. And then a few connections that mean that he's known to the king. And so the king pulls him up and sets him loose, especially in London, to try to get as much money as he can for him. And he's phenomenally successful. In less than 4 years, he raises, I think it's about £250,000. I think it's £225,000 for the king. And that's in 16th century money. It's about 1.5 million. Pounds in today's money, which I don't know, is that about $2 million?
He probably around there. Yeah,
he essentially almost doubles the crown revenue in a couple of years. He just is phenomenally successful at it, and not very nice about it either.
Yeah, but this makes him like maybe the most hated man in England.
yeah,
at least among the nobility. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, no, well, yeah. and sort of, especially in London, amongst the sort of common person, they absolutely despise him. He uses horrible thugs, essentially, to get money out of people. And so there's a story I tell in the book about a haberdasher named Thomas Sunniff, who he just pursues to within an inch of his life. He destroys his life over a couple hundred pounds. Which was a lot to Thomas Sunniff, but certainly wasn't a lot to the king. And, you know, for every one story that we're able to recreate, there's dozens, if not hundreds more, of people who are really driven to the edge.
We don't know, I don't think, from I remember reading it, that we don't really know what happened to Sunniff. At the end, I mean, we know he's... I think in the tower, I think, right at the end.
In the tower.
But then that's sort of where I think he re-meets, or he, Edmund is back at the tower at the same time. And
yeah, they write to each other.
Yeah. And he's like, hey, man, help me out. And he's like, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm here too.
Yeah, so I'm here too.
Not much I can do for you. Sorry, ruined your life. But I mean, and if I could help you, I would, but I don't. Yeah, yeah, I think you're going to need to find satisfaction elsewhere. It's not looking good for me.
But he does ask him to pray for him, which is a bit cheeky, I think, given the circumstances. We don't know what happens to Thomas Sunniff. Probably he ends up released because there is this sort of general pardon that happens. But he's still probably... can't resurrect his livelihood.
Sure.
Right? I mean, he's been in prison for the last several years. So his life is probably ruined by Edmund Dudley, and there's many, many more like him.
Mm-hmm. So how does Edmund meet his fate after the death of Henry VII? Kind of, sort of seems like chicken's coming home to roost a little bit.
I think poetically it's just legally it's not. Essentially, the only person who remotely likes him or wants him alive, at least in the court, is Henry VII. And so when he dies, there's no protection for him. Henry VIII is a very young man at that point. He's just shy of his 18th birthday, and so it's sort of everyone around him who's running the show, and they keep the death of Henry VII secret for a few days. It's a lot like if you've seen the film Death of Stalin, with people coming in and out of the room and all this political planning going on.
That's such a good movie.
Yeah, well, it's exactly like that. So they arrest Edmund Dudley on charges of treason, which are entirely ridiculous. They said that he planned to overthrow the government and kill the king and everything else. And he absolutely didn't. There's no way that is even remotely likely. But didn't really matter. And so he's charged with and convicted of treason. And imprisoned in the Tower for a while. He writes a book in there. As we said, he's corresponding with all the people whose lives he ruined.
Memoir.
Yeah, well, it's advice to the king, which again is tricky.
Yeah.
And he's in there for a while until Henry VIII really realizes how unpopular Edmund Dudley was and how much sort of political capital he can gain by having him executed. And so he's out on progress and sends back orders to have him killed. And that's the end of Edmund Dudley.
Yeah. So how does the Dudley family stay afloat after this? Because now, they have that stain on their family name, you know, this mark of treason. And he has, Edmund has small children. The one that will be the most prominent is his son, John, who is 5 or 6 years old at the time of his father's death. And So what keeps the family afloat? And then how are they do they slowly get back into the good graces of the crown?
I mean, the answer to this will be the same answer it will be the next time they fall as well. And it's the women. The women consistently managed to resurrect the Dudley family after the men kind of screw it up. They come in and
they're the glue.
Keep it all going. Yeah, very, very much. Yeah. And so in this case, it's Edmund's widow, Elizabeth Grey, who is actually of much higher standing than he is, has all sorts of courtly connections. And knows how to play the game much, much better. Edmund just refuses. He throws out the rule book. He can't be bothered with the game. She knows it. And somehow, and we don't know how, and we don't know the circumstances or anything else, but within a year of Edmund's execution, or just over a year, I think it's November of the next year, she is married to the king's uncle. Which is amazing, if you think about it. Now, he's an illegitimate uncle. He's
a Plantagenet, right?
Henry's mother's illegitimate brother. He's an illegitimate son of Edward IV, named Arthur Plantagenet. But the fact that this marriage happens, you know, she's the widow of an executed traitor. I think she's clever and does something clever and wily, and to secure this. So she ends up essentially Henry VIII's aunt, kind of out of nowhere, which then allows her to make arrangements to protect her children and ensure that they are in a good situation. And so John ends up in the home of Sir Edward Guildford, who's master of the king's armory, and he raises John as his ward, which means that John gets a very chivalric military education. He's in the armory helping out his guardian and ends up this sort of young military man. And that's what gains him really entry into the court as a young man. He's fighting in the battlefields in France under Charles Brandon, the king's best friend, and is knighted there. And then when he returns, he's participating and organizing jousts and all of those things that Henry VIII loves and appreciates. And that's really his ticket back in. which is phenomenal again for the son of a traitor who himself was just a lawyer.
Yeah, actually, if you don't mind, now that you brought up jousting, the tournaments. There's a lot of purpose behind them. It's not just you know, letting off. I mean, well, it is letting off steam and fun and games and all that. But I mean, there's a purpose behind them. And so, what were these tournaments like? And you know, what was the point of these tournament games?
Yeah, it is easy to sort of just dismiss them as men getting dressed up in funny costumes and beating each other around the head with sticks, which is what it was. But there is a lot more to it. They were sort of popularity contests. They were opportunities to show off, to sort of peacock in front of very important people. But really what they were about was, they were war games. They were opportunities to show off martial skill in the context of the court, which was seen as extremely valuable. They had cultural elements as well. You know, they would often pull on things like King Arthur or Robin Hood, or you know, all of these stories that were just as popular in the Tudor era as they are today. And they also had elements of courtly love. So, you know, there would be mottos that would profess love for certain people, and the king would ideally profess his love for his wife, the queen, though not always. and so they were these performances of chivalry, and these opportunities for young men, such as John Dudley, to make connections and make a name, become known to important people, including the king.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned he is going to be the ward, grows up the ward of Sir Edward Guildford, and he actually ends up marrying Edward's daughter, Jane, who are they're about the same age. And it seems really like a very, very good match. They seem to make a really good team together. Like they both know what they're doing. You know what I mean? Like they're united in their plan, and it seems to be beyond that, somewhat of a love match too. I mean, they really both seem to be very, you know, into each other, which is not common, you know, back then.
No, in some ways it's this phenomenal, somewhere between a love story and a sort of power coupling. I really enjoyed spending time with, if you can use that phrase, John and Jane. They marry, she's about 16, he's 21. They grew up together. They'd known each other since he'd arrived in the Guildford household when he was about seven or eight. There's for all his detractors, and there are many, both in his time and since, there's never been a hint of any infidelity or any sign that they didn't get on. She refers to him much, much later as the most best gentleman ever living woman was matched with all. They also had 13 children. So that's a good sign.
Too busy for infidelity. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And you know, even amongst nobles, you stop after two or three if you don't like each other. 13 is, you know, over a stretch of about 25 years, they have 13 children. I mean, you know, there was something going on there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, definitely. anyway, so. Maybe we should just a little bit talk about Henry VIII and just sort of his personality. What is he like? I know everyone sort of knows about all his wives and that whole situation. But now, what is Henry, especially the young Henry, what is he like? What's his personality like? How is it, you know, how does he establish himself as a king?
I think the best presentation or representation I've ever seen of Henry VIII, based on all the time that I've spent working on him and his reign, is in that wonderful classic film, Man for All Seasons, where he's this sort of big, loud, mm-hmm. Very sort of slightly confrontational, but very full of himself kind of figure, who expects everyone to laugh at his jokes and kowtow to his brilliance. I think there's often a presentation of Henry VIII where he changes, you know, sometime around 1536, he goes from being this lovable youth who everyone adores to this mad tyrant. Mm. And I think that there is an escalation that happens in the 1530s. But I'm actually spending a lot of time with him on another project that I'm just finishing up now. And there are really early signs of sort of his father's paranoia, of this real fear that turns into aggression and tyranny.
It's a family trait, it seems like.
Yeah, I really think so. There's this paranoia and temper that really runs through the Tudors. Elizabeth has it as well, and I'm sure we'll come on to her. So he's someone to be very, very careful of, and someone who holds immense power and does everything he can to hold as much power as possible. So the fact that John gets into the court and I'm sure we'll come to this, navigates it, he and Jane navigate it with such dexterity and success is phenomenal. Clearly, he has a read on Henry VIII. And he knows the people to ally himself with, the people to stay away from. There are few who manage to rise through the reign of Henry VIII without falling, and they do it.
Yeah, it's an incredible rise. Maybe we should probably talk about that, because, I mean, he basically goes from, John goes from a commoner, to a dukedom. I mean, I know the dukedom doesn't come until Edward, but I mean, within the space of 45 years, which seems, I don't know how it usually goes for dukedoms, but it seems like that's a really quick, meteoric, rise up the ladder of the nobility.
Yeah. Well, it's just worth saying, you know, for those who aren't familiar with it, I mean, I wasn't until I started doing this sort of work. The levels of nobility, I mean, dukedoms tend to only go to relatives of the royal family, of the king and maybe the queen. It's you know, you think about dukes today, right? The Duke and Duchess of Sussex, it's Prince Harry and Meghan, right? You know, like it's those sorts of people who are dukes. So the fact that he becomes a duke at all is incredible, especially when there's no history in the family whatsoever of a dukedom. You know, it's
He wasn't even a knight
getting his great. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
until he was like 19 or 20, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and he does it for himself essentially. He creates his own dukedom. There was no dukedom of Northumberland until he came along, and he's like, I'll have that one. So it is amazingly impressive that he's able to do that.
Yeah, but before we get to that, his dukedom, there's sort of a hinge point or a pivotal moment in English history. And that is when Henry decides he's going to annul his marriage with Catherine of Aragon and then marry Anne Boleyn because he needs an heir. He needs a male heir. And like I said, that decision going against the Pope and basically telling the Pope to stuff it. And I'm going to, you know, church is independent now, buddy. Nothing you can do about it. Huge hinge moment in English history. So how do the Dudleys, what does this mean for the Dudleys? How do they manage this period?
Yeah, I in many ways, being on the right side of that, and I don't mean morally or anything else or religiously, you know, just being politically on the right side of that is what allows them to vault a fair bit. They ally themselves with those we would now call Protestants at the court, those who were on the side of ditching the Pope. They also ally themselves with Thomas Cromwell, who's sort of at the head of that, and who really manages that break with Rome. And very soon after, when Henry does marry Anne Boleyn, we find John and Jane's son in this sort of schoolroom that is overseen by a French exile who, again, we now call Protestant, who was brought over by Anne Boleyn. And John, one of his first very sort of elevated, I guess, court appearances, is carrying some of the gifts in the christening of Anne Boleyn's daughter, Elizabeth. And he's the only one at the level of a knight who appears. Everybody else is a proper noble, and he's in there. So it's very, very clear that what side of that he's on. And he sort of is carried on the coattails of the right people who are rising very, very quickly at that point.
Yeah. So Henry, basically we're going to have three different children with three different queens, Mary's from Catherine of Aragon, Elizabeth Anne Boleyn, and then Edward, or who will become Edward VI, is Jane Seymour's.
Jane Seymour, exactly. And yeah. Note the last name, Seymour, mm-hmm. who is, that family is very, very close with the Dudleys. Edward Seymour, her brother, is very, very close friends, almost brotherly with John Dudley. And they are for decades. They had met in France as young men on the battlefield, and they are allies through the whole reign of Henry VIII. So the fact that they have that connection to the Seymours, who then become kin to the heir to the throne, again, very, very important to the success of the Dudleys.
Right. And back then,
who you know.
Yeah, exactly. But back then, even though Edward is the youngest of Henry's three children, because he's male, he hops over Mary and Elizabeth.
Yeah.
So when
they only changed that like a few years ago, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
That is true. Say way back then, but like they literally changed it, I think, in the last 5 years.
But then Henry VIII dies and Edward VI is still just a young child at the time of his succession to the crown, or is taking up the crown. So Henry basically sets up a council to sort of run things for Edward and look after him. And John Dudley is on this council, and John very quickly sort of takes control of this council. He's sort of the...
Well, it's Edward Seymour who really, I mean, he does away with the council. So it's Edward the Sixth's uncle, Edward Seymour, who becomes Lord Protector when Henry VIII hadn't wanted a Lord Protector, because Lord Protectors have a tendency to just overthrow whatever's going on and make themselves kings. And so Henry VIII didn't want that. But within a couple weeks, Edward Seymour has himself made Lord Protector and is king in all but name. And running things. And John Dudley, as his sort of friend and right-hand man, is benefiting from that as well, and generally supporting what it is that Seymour wants and does up until a point. Because Seymour, how do I put this, mucks it up pretty badly. He rules he's accused of ruling a bit like a tyrant, not really listening to the advice of the council, who still exists, but he's just not listening to them. There's all sorts around agricultural policy and religious policy.
Yeah, everything seems to go wrong for Edward.
He just goes wrong. And so John Dudley is sent out to put down a rebellion, which he does successfully, but then he marches the army back to London and overthrows Seymour and takes control himself. But he refuses to have Seymour executed. There's all sorts of calls to have Seymour executed. And there's this great scene, which is related to us by an ambassador, at the council where all these people are out for Seymour's blood and head. And John Dudley puts his hand on the hilt of his sword and says, "He that would have his blood would have mine also." And everyone shuts up because he's such a military man. He's such an imposing presence. Yeah, awesome. Exactly. Yeah. And they all shut up. And so Dudley overthrows Seymour, but has him rehabilitated and placed back in the council because, you know, he is his friend. And he's not just going to throw him to the wolves that quickly.
Yeah. And then, as you said, so John becomes sort of the man behind the throne. At one point, he's basically the most powerful. I mean, at this point, he's basically the most powerful man in England. You know, makes himself a duke. But then Edward gets sickly and has sort of a sort of prolonged illness and dies very young, I think at 15 or 16 years old. And then of course, there's going to be something of a succession crisis, and John ends up backing or maybe grasping he backs the wrong queen, and that's
he backs the right. Okay, so
technically yes, that'd be technically
I'm being less technical, and actually strategically at the time no one thought so. John does eventually have Edward Seymour executed, mostly for plotting to kill him, which, you know, actually seems fair enough. And then Edward VI falls ill, and he writes something called the device or plan for the succession, whereby he skips those two half-sisters, Mary and Elizabeth. And initially, and you can see it, if you have a chance to look it up, you can find the document. We've still got it online. And you can just about read it too. It's actually quite legible even for modern eyes. You can see in it, he originally writes that the crown will go to his cousin, Lady Jane's heirs male. So it skips her too, right? He's just looking for the nearest guy essentially to give the throne to. And Jane, Lady Jane, is married. And so she might be pregnant and might have a son. But then Edward quickly realizes that he's not going to make it to her having a son, and he adds "and her," and so it becomes Lady Jane and her heirs male, which means it goes to her. Now, Lady Jane, as I said, is married, and she's married to Guildford Dudley, John Dudley's son. So the exact influence and sequence of events, we just don't know. But yes, when Edward VI dies, he intends the throne to go to Lady Jane. She's known as Lady Jane Grey. She's actually Lady Jane Dudley. The contender, according to Henry VIII's will, of course, is Mary, his eldest daughter. But no one at the time thought she had any chance of taking back the throne. Even her allies were like, you got to get the heck out of Dodge. Come go to France, go to Spain. You know, you're not going to beat John Dudley, this military commander of great reputation and experience and renown. And so everyone thought it was going to go the way of Queen Jane. But they underestimated Mary. She had huge support. Fair amount of money, and it doesn't even get to a battle. John is forced to surrender without
they kind of chicken out, like everyone back in London sort of just leaves him hanging.
As soon as he leaves, and again, you can tell what a presence he was. He's holding it together himself. His personality is holding it together. And as soon as he leaves, they switch and pull the rug out from underneath him, and that's it. He's marched back to the tower as a traitor.
Yeah, but it's funny because, you know, you talk about this in the book. I mean, the people that are standing judgment upon him are the people who are like, all right, here's what we're doing. Lady Jane Grey or Lady, you know, Queen Mary, Queen Jane Dudley. Here's the legal. It has the seal. You know, everything's on the up and up. Here you go.
Yeah.
And then they're like, ah, you're. you know, traitor against the true queen. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, you gave me the, like, you guys right here, you and you and you and you were the ones that signed off on it. So if I am a traitor, aren't you guys all traitors too? And they're like, that's immaterial.
Yeah. And it's fascinating, isn't it? It's fascinating because unlike his father, the treason, you know, he did everything he was accused of, right? He did mount, he put together an army against the now queen, Queen Mary. He declared for Queen Jane, all of that sort of stuff. But he was told to by the monarch, right? Both Edward and then Jane. And he did it with the full approval of the council, who, you're absolutely right, were then in judgment on him. So he's like, yeah, I did it, but is it treason? And they're like, yes, yeah, it definitely is. And only you. And so, yeah, he is executed for treason. Weirdly, almost exactly 43 years to the day after his father was executed for treason.
Yeah. And he's not the only one, obviously. The Lady Jane has to go, as the, you know, pretender, and her husband, Guildford, also, and then another one of the Dudley sons is executed as well, correct?
So Guildford Dudley is executed alongside his wife Jane, sort of after. There's some time after. Mary doesn't seem to actually want to execute them, which is quite nice. And then sort of her, she's arm is twisted. But it's the eldest son, John, named for his father. He falls ill, essentially.
Oh, that's right.
In the tower, and is released and dies 3 days later. So yeah, you very, very quickly you start, you know, of those 13 children born, we've already lost some in infancy because it's the 16th century. But we're also rapidly running through the remaining Dudley children, especially in the aftermath of the succession crisis.
And then there's three sons left at this point. There's Robert and Harry and Ambrose.
The one everyone forgets. Yeah, Ambrose. So Ambrose is actually the eldest at this point. Was not born anywhere near the eldest, but is the eldest at this point. Followed by Robert, and then Henry.
Like the Kennedys. There's like the Kennedys. The kids are just falling all over the place, you know.
And so Henry, who I call Harry in the book, because he has an older brother named Henry. They had so many children, they were reusing names.
Lots of Henrys in the book. Lots of Henrys and Johns and Edwards and
I know,
Williams
I know. I am
and Anns and Marys.
That.
And Elizabeths and Catherines.
But, by the end, everyone's named Robert. So there's Ambrose, Robert, and Harry, who are left, and then very, very soon it's just Ambrose and Robert, because Harry, when they're released, they go to war with the French on behalf of Mary's consort, Philip II, and Harry, unfortunately, who was probably only a teenager. I don't think he was more than about 17 years old and may have been as young as 13, dies, fighting in France. And Robert talks about this memory being seared, in his eyes, for the rest of his life, watching his younger brother fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Robert, becomes sort of like the third main character in the book. Is going to become, Mary's reign is very short. She dies and Elizabeth takes over. But so Robert is going to become something of a lifelong intimate with the Queen Elizabeth. And I don't mean intimate in the physical sense, although that might have happened. We don't really
know. It's a good choice of words.
Yeah. But he's certainly an emotional intimate. And it seems like, from what we can tell, it seems like if they're not in love, they're very close to it. And there's some sort of very deep emotional connection that the two have with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I constantly get asked, you know, the did they, didn't they question. And we don't know. There are arguments either side, you know, and evidence either side, but we don't know.
Just to say though, it's like it's not like today where it's sort of, I mean, where it's sort of easy, like, you know, you can just meet up at a Motel 6 or something like that. You know, like it's very like you think, well, it's the queen, she can do whatever she wants, but like her life is, I mean, there's always people around her. There's some sort of servants or courtiers or whatever. So it's not just like they can just, you know, meet in a bedroom and no one's going to notice. Like,
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons she gives why, you know, to dispel the rumors. That being said, it is also the case that at various points, very large gifts go to the sort of people who do surround them both, from both of them, very large gifts. And there is a case in the book that I talk about, one of her ladies who would sleep in her chamber manages to sneak from Elizabeth's chamber into Robert's chamber, not for hanky panky, actually, as it turns out, but and sneak back in and nobody notices. She isn't the queen, but you know, these sorts of passageways are open, and Robert is always right next to wherever the queen is staying. So I don't know. No. But they were very, very close. It is very emotional. It's very heated. It's very dramatic. You know, when she's angry at Robert, she's very, very angry with him. When she's feeling, you know, more positively towards Robert, it's very, very positive. And we have the last letter that he writes to her right before he dies, very unexpectedly. And in her own handwriting, she writes on it his last letter, and she keeps it by her bedside until her own death, which is quite a bit later. So he is incredibly special to her. And for his own part, he essentially misses the boat on having children of his own in order to maintain his connection and his relationship to her.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of talk, rumors that they're going to marry. And a lot of people think that, you know, might be a good idea.
But some people think it might be
some
a
people,
idea.
Not every, people, yeah, not, a lot of people, lot of people don't, really but a lot bad. Of, but like there's, but it's, you know, basically every option that she has, you know, some people, you know, all right, this could work.
Yeah.
But, and then a lot of people are like, no, I don't like this one. So there are no like great options on the table for Elizabeth, it seems like, but, so why does she decide not to marry Robert? Because it's, he's definitely willing, it seems. I mean, granted, he's also married on his own at this point.
Which is one of the main reasons, yeah.
But I mean, but as we've seen in this period, you know, these things can be dealt with in one way, one shape or form. I mean, and if she had decided that he's my guy, I'm sure that would have happened. So why does Elizabeth not choose not to marry Robert when there seems to be such a connection between them already to begin with?
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of two questions there, and they are interconnected, and sort of one is, why doesn't she marry at all? Right. And there are big reasons there. I mean, she doesn't have a great role model when it comes to marriage. Right. And her father did go through wives very quickly.
Right, but yeah, but by not marrying, that means there's no heir, which means the Tudor dynasty
expires.
Well,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I mean, there is. The other is, you know, she's the great sort of ditherer. She puts things off, and she doesn't like making decisions where people could argue against it. So the fact that there is no perfect option, and Robert certainly isn't one. It's also worth remembering. So, you know, there's that. There's why she doesn't marry at all, and then there's why she doesn't marry Robert. I mean, Robert is the grandson, son, and brother of convicted executed traitors. So that's not great. For the first few years of her reign, he is married, and then his wife dies in mysterious circumstances in which he is implicated. You know, it's found to be an accident, but all around Europe, they think he did it. the ambassador to France talks about his ears glowing with all the gossip that it's Robert. And so for her to marry someone who is not only the grandson, son, and brother of executed traitors, but may have killed his wife is not a great look for her. And then politically, there's all sorts of reasons why that might be a problem. But yeah, again, you know, I think we have to go to that bigger question of why she doesn't marry at all. She talks about, you know, that this, it will have one mistress and no master. You know, if anyone she marries, because she's a woman, automatically gets put above her. And she doesn't want anyone in that position, which is entirely fair enough. And so the only way to keep men beneath her is not to marry them, and to keep them, you know, like Henry VII did with finances, right? To keep everyone in these chains of loyalty to her. And she's able to do that, with Robert. And I think it's fair enough. I'm not sure he could have been trusted. As much affection as they had for each other.
I mean, it's certainly, like you said, ambitions. I mean, where the Tudors seem to be have sort of a paranoid gene, the Dudleys seem to have a highly ambitious gene. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I mean, he was, you know, he had on average, every 18 months, he had a portrait commissioned of himself. Right. I mean, he was a bit.
So like you're saying, if there was, you know, Instagram back then, he would have been
insufferable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he definitely had that streak. Mm-hmm. He might have been a horrible king consort, where he was quite a good favorite, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm. But of course, when he remarries years later, I think he's in his 40s or mid 40s at this point. Mm-hmm. She's furious, and he tries to keep it a secret from her as long as possible. But when she finds out, she is incredibly, incredibly pissed off at John Dudley, for Robert Dudley for getting married.
Yeah. I mean, not only for marrying, right, which she was never going to be pleased about. It's why he refuses to marry. You know, he does have a son with a mistress and refuses to marry her because he knows that he'll lose the favor of the queen. So when he does marry, he marries probably the worst possible person he could marry, which is Elizabeth's younger, hotter cousin, essentially, Lettice Knowles, who may have been related to Elizabeth I twice. Because she's a Boleyn, she may have been as well a Tudor. She may have been descended from an illegitimate child of Henry VIII. So she's possibly related to Elizabeth twice over, and is incredibly gorgeous. Looks like her, but prettier. So it's a very poor choice strategically. I think that they were probably in love. They've known each other for a very, very long time. He had been godfather to her son years and years before. He also, I think, by that point is aware that Elizabeth is not going to marry him. And that he is his family's last chance to have an heir. And so he needs to get married. They try to keep it secret. That lasts longer than it should, really, in a court where, as you say, everybody's watching everyone. They manage to keep it a secret from the queen for a very, very long time. But when she finds out, she explodes, and she is never again and she and Lettice have been very good friends, as well as kinswomen. They're never in the same room. I don't think the same building ever again.
She refuses. It does seem like a story. I mean, just the way that things go, like he needs heirs, right? Or at least one singular heir. So it seems like a strange choice because Lettice is somewhat older. It's not like she's, you know, 19, 20 years old where she's got all these, you know, sort of childbearing years available to her. So Lettice is in her mid-30s, something like that. So, and like, you're not leaving yourself a lot of time, and, you know, especially if something goes wrong. So it seems like a very strange choice, just in that respect.
Yeah, I think it is a love match in many ways. I mean, they do have a child together, a son, who unfortunately dies at the age of 3. He's very much adored by his parents. They refer to him as the noble imp. Robert has 3 portraits commissioned of his son before he's 3 years old, which is unheard of in the Tudor period. You wouldn't do that. But what's very interesting is when their son dies, as I said, very young, Robert receives a letter from someone essentially very rudely kind of going, it's okay, you might have more. And Robert responds that he doesn't think that he'll have any more children because of his advanced age, which of course is not a barrier to a man having children. But I think it written into that is his allegiance to Lettice and his love for Lettice, that because she's beyond her childbearing years, so is he.
And then that's really it for both the Tudors and the Dudleys. They both don't have an heir, and then the family lines just sort of extinguish, the Dudleys first, and then the Tudors with the death of Elizabeth in the early 17th century.
I mean, there is a sort of coda, which is that there's sort of 2 lines that the Dudleys can go down. One is Robert's illegitimate son, who is a crazy good time. He tries to circumnavigate the globe. He then runs off with his cousin, despite being married to someone else in England. He runs off with his cousin to Italy and marries her. And they have, I think, like 15, 18 children in Italy, which is how you end up with like Cosimo Dudley and things like that. So there's that line, but he's illegitimate. And then the other line is the Sydneys. So that's Robert's sister, Mary. Again, women coming in, right? Saving things. She has children, and the Sydneys are still the heirs to the Dudleys today.
Right, yes. But the Dudley name itself is... Yes.
Yeah, got it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, geez, I've already kept you over an hour. I don't want to keep much longer.
That's my fault for writing such a long book.
No, but there's just, I mean, no, it's not even that. It's, what is it, about 375 pages. It's not too bad.
Yeah,
it's but there's just a lot of shit in the, you know, going on in this period.
Yeah.
It's a heavy time. But anyway, just wrapping up this whole period, I guess, just sort of exit question I ask everybody that comes on the podcast is, you know, what would you like the audience to get out of this book, or, you know, what's the one thing you'd want a reader taking away from the book, having read it?
I think I would want them to feel something. I think there is a tendency with history. I mean, it can obviously be written very dry. And if anyone out there, and there might be one of you who's ever read any of my academic work, it can be very, very dry. And to be very intellectual in our understanding of the past. And I think there's a place for that. You know, I still write academically, and I think that that's important. And I draw on academic works for my trade writing because it's very, very important. But there's a way of connecting with the past that is more emotional as well, and doesn't have to be, you know, sort of bodice ripping drama either. It's just what people went through. And I think a family history especially can lock into that, can tap into that because of that sense of loyalty, of a family, of love. And that's what I tried to capture in the story of the Dudleys. So I'd hope that they'd feel something that would connect them to the past.
Yeah, well, I think you definitely succeeded. It's a fantastic book. And I know, I mean, you mentioned, you know, academic writing, and I agree with you. It's important. But it's also much harder to do something like this, I think, skillfully, you know. It's just, I mean, anybody, any old PhD can, or not even a PhD, you know, can just, you know, hack out a monograph or something that, but actually creating a narrative that has, that flows and has force and sort of, you know, sort of takes you along on a ride. Not everybody can do that. It's a very special skill. And I got to say, you have that skill. This, it's a fantastic history of that period.
Thank you. So, I appreciate that very much.
No problem. So yeah, before we go, is there anything else you want to plug while we're here? Anything you're working on or any appearances or anything?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, the paperback is now out in North America. I came out last month. So it's still hot and fresh. So do pick it up, local bookstores if you can. I have just finished the manuscript of the next book. I don't think I'm allowed to say what it's about. I don't think so. I will say that it is on a very important figure who does appear in this book, and I will say more soon. That's all I will say on that. It should be out early next year. So I'm, you know, if you're on Twitter or X or whatever, keep an eye out.
Yeah. Is there any website or social media, anything you want people to follow to keep, keep abreast of what's going on?
Yeah, I have a website. It's just joannepaul.com. Very easy. On there, you can sign up for a monthly newsletter where I keep everyone up to date. And I also do a book club and a monthly interview with a historian. So there's some added content to that as well. I'm on X or Twitter, which Twitter. Is at Joanne_Paul_. And then I'm on Instagram as Dr. Joanne Paul. I'm not on TikTok because I can't figure it out.
All right. I have no social media.
It's too much for me. That's enough. Oh, I'm on Facebook. I have a professional Facebook account, so you can share.
Okay, there you go. All right. Well, again, the book is The House of Dudley, A New History of Tudor England. As I said before, the book is fantastic. It's also a very handsome book. I've had this complaint for a while that always seems like in the US when there's a book that's published in the UK first, the UK edition always gets it always just looks better. I don't know why, like they just get like the graphic design on the UK books is always better. But I really, love the way this one is put together.
They did a fantastic job. Yeah. And there's some great image inserts as well, which help you visualize it, which I think is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. So fantastic history. I could easily see this turning the Dudley story of the generations into sort of like a prestige TV series on, like an HBO or Showtime or Stars or something like that. Yeah. I don't know. But it's a very... So if you're a fan of, if anyone out there, I know I sort of, brought it up mockingly a little bit before, Game of Thrones, very similar dynamic, just, with just how power operates in the whole that whole dance with in the court itself. It's just a very, very fantastic piece of history. So highly, highly recommend it to everybody. Again, the name is The House of Dudley, A New History of Tudor England, now out in paperback. So check that out. And my guest today, Dr. Joanne Paul. So Dr. Paul, thank you so much again for coming on the podcast. And thank you
for having me on.
Yeah. And thank you for, taking all the time out of your life to actually, write this book and put it together so that we could all read it and enjoy the fruits of your labor. So thanks so much.
Thank you. I loved writing this book. I hope you enjoy reading it.
Yeah. Thanks. All right. And again, if you like this podcast, please consider leaving us a 5-star review and sharing with your friends. And if you have any questions or comments or have any books or any suggestions you'd like to see for the podcast, you can reach out to me at tbenson@heartland.org. That's tbenson@heartland.org. And for more information about the Heartland Institute, you can just go to heartland.org. And we do have our Twitter account for the podcast, Twitter account for the podcast. You can reach us there, you know, for the, sort of the same reasons. Our Twitter handle is at illbooks, at ILL books. So make sure you check that out. And that's pretty much it. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you guys next time. Take care. Love you, Robbie. Love you, Mom. Bye-bye. Prepare your thing.